But like, if you just think for a second about acid rain, like that is a terrifying thing to teach to kids. Yeah. So I guess like we're trying to move towards the subject of climate change and environmentalism and stuff. Mm-hmm. We've done long-termism for a while. We did logic for a while, and we're kind of ambling our way towards this new subject. Yeah. But
we take breaks, you know.
Yeah, we take breaks, and we'll slowly get there. Yeah. But I'm so fascinated by this whole thing because first, it's a massive goddamn subject. It's not as if it's one that can just be addressed in like a conversation or two. But as a way to start getting towards that, we thought it would be fun to talk just a bit about like the state of the debate right now, because mm-hmm. I think that unlike a lot of these other niche subjects, which we had discussed on the podcast, this one we can be pretty sure our audience has strong opinions about, or at least is aware of it. And so as a way to kind of get into it, we thought we would just give some scattershot observations about what we see going right, what we see going wrong. So what's my, like, where are we coming from? My position basically is climate change is obviously real. It's obviously man-made. CO2 is a greenhouse gas, but it's not going to be the end of the world. It's not going to be an apocalypse. We're not going to, like, I think Greta Thunberg somewhere said that by the year 2030, civilization as we know it will end.
AOC has also said this, like, in 12 years' time, civilization will end. So if this is not the time to panic, when is the time to panic? And this is one thing that was oddly gratifying as I started studying this, which was, you know, I was a little bit reluctant to because there's just so much, like, social pressure to like lean a certain way, and there's just, it's heated, man. This debate is fucking intense. But as I realized as I was studying this, trying to take like my identity out of it a little bit, that this debate actually has the makings of just a great epistemological debate, because look, it's got probability and models, like how to think about like mathematical models and stuff. It's got elements of like utopianism and incrementalism, like how do we go about solving problems, and are problems like inevitable, and like, you know, if we can just rid ourselves of the evil that is climate change, we'll reach like a utopian state, right? It's got elements of like religiosity, mm-hmm. right, when it comes to like thinking of the environment as just something like perfect that humans are trespassing upon. Okay. Yeah. It's got those kind of elements. It's got economic arguments, of course, too. It's got capitalism and just like a total restructuring of society. It has like it's got obviously like a lot of moral consequences dealing with the poorest, the least advantage or the most disadvantaged people, right? Like, you know, it's just in terms of like the amount of things that this debate touches on that we've talked about before, it's fantastically interesting.
Yeah, it's a rich territory
as a subject. Yeah, it's very rich. And I think because it's got all these, like, it touches on all these different areas, possibly why there's like so much polarization and stuff around it, mm-hmm. is because mm-hmm. if you have like strong opinions in any of these domains, these kind of all come clashing together and like then make for a mega storm of like a debate mm-hmm. around climate change. So one question I want to ask you at the beginning is just, why are the political parties so evenly divided? Like, is this a residual effect of Al Gore sort of bringing this to the public's attention and having been like a presidential candidate, and that sort of automatically politicizes things? So, you know, obviously as it is right now, sort of the left is the most sympathetic towards like climate change, doing something and often doing something drastic to try and avoid mm-hmm. this problem. And the right is typically like more hesitant about taking drastic action on this side. But like, just try and imagine a world where like the politics are reversed a little bit, right? So imagine a world where liberals are like just very concerned about the poorest nations on the planet and having them like develop as quickly as possible. In that case, you could imagine liberals actually being hesitant to take any drastic climate actions, because if you want like the poorest nations to develop as quickly as possible, that's probably going to be via the same route that like the most developed nations took, right? And that developing nations are indeed taking right now. This is just like via coal and fossil fuels, etc. And then maybe you can imagine conservatives sort of being concerned about limiting like the freedom of people who will be affected by climate change, like if we don't do anything, right? And being like concerned about people in Vanuatu or something, or one of these like low sitting islands, like that will probably get hit first by any like rising sea levels. So anyway, what I was trying to do is like imagine a world where the liberal and conservative like stereotypical position is sort of reversed, and try and ask myself, like, why is it the case, obviously, that like liberals are so worried about climate change in general and conservatives are not? I don't think we can just be like it's an anti-science pro-science thing, because there are obviously positions on which I think liberals are out to lunch on the science, like GMOs and stuff, right? So it's not obvious, like liberals, we can't just say are the party of science. It's just like very much overly simplified. So yeah, I'm just curious what your thoughts on the politics of it.
So I think it's easy to imagine a world where environmentalism was a cause of the right, because I think that was the case in like the 1970s.
And where, it's why the EPA was developed in the US, actually.
Exactly. So like Richard Nixon and stuff created the EPA in the 1970s. And so Al Gore definitely had a part of it, right? So his Inconvenient Truth definitely solidified it as a cause of the left. Mm-hmm. I think another component is that it is genuinely very difficult to figure out what is true in this particular context. And so people tend to default to their political tribe, because that's like the easiest way to form an opinion is to think what people around you think. And we all do this. I'm not saying I don't do it. We all do it. So given that I think that this subject is genuinely very complicated, it doesn't surprise me that such a complicated subject for which we don't have clear answers, that people will just tend to default to their side. So tell me if this resonates with you. You have one or two friends who are super duper passionate about climate change, and the rest of you kind of know it's a problem, but don't really want to talk about it because the amount of work that it would take to engage in a debate with the friends who are super animated would take like a month and a half, because you have to study the details of forest fires and the details of plastic in the ocean and the details of cap and trade programs compared to carbon taxation programs compared to. So you don't even really want to just enter into the conversation, because the people who are super intense about it are going to throw 1,000 references at you, which you can't possibly deal with in the span of a single conversation. So most of us we're just going to say it's a thing, and we don't want to get into it too much. And I think that causes political polarization, because you get the loudest voices taking a stand, and add a bit of the arbitrariness of like Al Gore's personal opinion, then defining what the democratic movement is going to be about. And all of these, I think, factors come into play to explain some of the polarization, but by no means is it the whole story. But what about you? Do you have any ideas?
I mean, for a long time, honestly, I did sort of blame Al Gore. I gotta admit, not fully, obviously, like, you know, nothing's just fully determined by what he said, but I do think he did tremendous harm with his film and Inconvenient Truth. I think, like, at this point, I think both sides would admit that a lot of the claims in that film were like drastically over exaggerated, and there was some very shoddy science that went on. That was fodder for anyone who wanted to disagree with him, and just the fact that he was like a presidential candidate just solidified it, I think, as a political issue. So I to a certain extent, I kind of hold him responsible. Say, like, come on, man. But I honestly, I don't know that much about it. Like, it's possible before that there was also some polarization around it. I don't know how. Like, I was young when that movie came out, honestly. I was in grade school. I was in like grade 2 or 3, so I don't honestly remember what the state of the debate was before that. But I do think it's interesting that you can come up with a thought experiment that frames like the left as being less concerned about climate change because taking drastic actions, or at least the actions that right now the left seems to prioritize, those actions would like hurt the poor, especially in developing nations, like pretty drastically. And so I think it's interesting, one, that it's like just that's not talked about very often, and two, you can come up with a thought experiment where like the left is not as concerned about climate change and more concerned about just like economic growth and like alleviating poverty than they seem to be pretty easily.
Ooh, I guess another difference, so thinking a bit more about like why there's a split, so there does seem to be a strong like Naomi Klein we hate capitalism and climate change is really just a symptom of capitalism, and therefore to fight climate change we need to destroy capitalism, yada yada, and that's been a consistent left-wing thing, right? So to the extent that people are concerned about climate change but really just hate the goddamn system and want to tear it to pieces. That does seem to be a bit more of an intrinsically left-wing thing, where climate change can just be like, here's a bit, maybe a better way to say it. Like, I don't think that white supremacists have too much of an interest in climate change. like, these things just don't really square together, but extreme Marxists could easily use climate change as yet another example of the, American imperialist empire destroying the world.
Totally. Yeah. For those who the words, imperialist colonialist rolls off the tongue like fucking candy at a fair. Yeah. But just to provide some quotes to back up what you were saying there. So Naomi Klein, I believe this is an article for The Nation, but I'll put the real source in the notes. She says, real climate solutions are ones that steer power and control to the community level, whether through community-controlled renewable energy, local organic agriculture, or transit systems genuinely accountable to their users, right? So she's like defining what climate solutions have to look like, and they have to change the power, that they have to change the hierarchy, right? They have to change the power system. Another quote from Amory Lovins back in 1977 was arguing already against nuclear power, and says, this is quite striking, I think. I'm actually not sure if it was a he or she, but they say, even if nuclear power were clean, safe, economic, assured of ample fuel, and socially benign, it would still be unattractive because of the political implications of the kind of energy economy it would lock us into, right? They would not dismantle the kind of power structures that leftists are typically very concerned with. So the left is like trying to, or certain people on the left are trying to define what acceptable solutions are already. So without going into too many of the details, this is one thing that is quite striking to me in the climate debate, which is just the voices that are most prominent on like the radical change of the climate change side arguing against nuclear power, right? So what we have here is like an argument that climate change is an absolute existential threat to humanity. And yet when presented with a solution still has some problems, but the problems are they're not existential in scope at all. When presented with a solution, they slap it down.
Yeah.
It's just, it's like a betrayal. Yeah. So as soon as I see rhetoric like that, especially stuff that doesn't deal with the actual problems of nuclear, which just like throws like taglines at it, or just says it's too expensive, or we don't know how to deal with the waste, like things that have just obviously been dealt with by like nuclear advocates at this point, really convinces me that people have like an ideological agenda here that's being pushed, right? But this is not a benign ideological agenda. This is the default status quo position of like climate change groups that have billions of dollars backing them up, like 350.org, Sierra Club, the whole Greta Thunberg stuff, AOC is against, you know, the Green New Deal is against nuclear stuff. Like it's striking, actually. So like,
So I'm a little bit self-conscious of us being in a, like a hard echo chamber conversation, right? So, because you and I think we agree fairly strongly, we should try to play devil's advocate a bit and also promise the audience that like we haven't gone into the details of nuclear power. Like we haven't really provided evidence for a lot of the stuff we're saying. And this is where your pushback will give us guidance. So if you think we're bullshitting on any of these claims, then tear us to pieces, because that
push
will
back like Tim Nguyen pushed back against Eric Weinstein.
So maybe go into that a bit more. What do you mean when you say that it's hurting the poor? Imagine someone sitting on the other side of the screen saying like,
what the fuck?
Bullshit. Like, yeah, like the best way to help the poor is to prevent floods and prevent rising sea levels. And why is the environmentalist movement actually not helping the poor?
Yeah, cool. What I mean by that is like the best way for the poor to become like more wealthy, more self-sustaining, to advance towards like better, more functioning democracies, basically to just like get themselves to levels comparable that like us in the West are lucky to have, are to have technologies that enable them to do so. And this technological development requires a lot of energy. Okay. So if you look at like developed nations versus developing nations use much more energy. And this is because we're trying to sustain a much higher standard of living, right? We're like constantly combating against elements to make ourselves comfortable. There's a lot of, you know, we all have access to the internet. We're all trying to talk to each other a lot. Like, we're using a lot of natural resources here to make our lives as one happy and two productive as possible. Mm-hmm. And to try and convince developing economies, especially, to move towards renewable forms of energy, which typically are like wind and solar, at a time when wind and solar just cannot provide enough energy, like not nearly as much energy as like coal, fossil fuels, nuclear, not nearly as much energy as these economies actually need to like devise technological solutions and like lift themselves out of poverty, ironically, is an actual form of like colonialism, I think, where you're like telling economies how they must develop, right? You are imposing economic restrictions on their development that developed economies were not at all subject to, right? So, and honestly, the developed nations that have moved towards more renewable source of energy, Germany comes to mind, and like certain states in the US, like the state of Vermont, their emissions, as they've tried to move towards things like just wind and solar, have fucking spiked, right? Mm-hmm. Compared to like places like France, that for at least a while, France until like 2010 or something, was like building more and more nuclear plants. Those emissions were like drastically lowered, right? But then, you know, as France got on the renewables train.
Germany did renewables and France did nuclear.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And Germany started shutting down nuclear plants and started developing coal, and like the emissions spiked. And just, you know, the fact is, like, you know, if we want happy people, people need energy. It's hard. This argument is hard because there's like so many things going on, right? Because there's people who argue like, you know, what we should do as like a species is like revert back to like a natural state where we're all just, there's less people on the planet, right? Like in Bill McKibben's, who is like, I think 350.org's founder or something. He argues in his first book, there should only be between like 100 million people and like a billion people or 2 billion people on the planet at all, right? So one, if you've ever heard an anti-humanist argument, this is it, right? Mm-hmm. So we need to basically kill off like 5 billion people. But there, so there'd be people arguing that, you know, we just need to like live off the land better, right? We need to like revert to like a sort of like a state of nature almost, where we're like, we're not using as much technology and stuff. But for, I guess, reasons we can get into, I like could totally reject that. I think, we want people, you know, as especially developed nations have like taken off in terms of prosperity, wealth, health, happiness, and what's gone along with that and what's made that possible is like uses of energy. And we want to make that, what we want to look for is like uses of energy that are as sustainable as possible. And quite frankly, renewables just aren't there yet. And so asking economies, developing economies, to like rid themselves of the exact things that we know actually create prosperity is directly hampering their progress.
I agree with you so much. It's hard to play devil's advocate, but but I just wanted to maybe slow down a little bit and develop some of the ideas that you just put onto the table, because I think they're all super important. So first, on the energy thing, I think Bill Gates gave a great, not even a talk, I think he just mentioned this in an interview once, that when you think about energy sources, you want to think of at least three dimensions. So there's energy density. So for one lump of coal, how long can you power your house compared to one lump of wood compared to one lump of uranium? So that's energy density. And then there's reliability, which is also very important. So how reliable is a energy source? So windmills and solar panels don't work when it's not windy or sunny. And so in order to sustain a city on windmills and solar panels, you need to have other forms of energy as backup to provide energy for your city when those sources are unavailable. And that's why, counterintuitively, because you mentioned Germany, right? So counterintuitively, they started building more windmills and solar panels and moving their grid to renewable. And in so doing, they deactivated the more expensive fossil fuel plants, which was natural gas. So they replaced natural gas with renewables. But then when it's not winding or sunning, then they have to use something. And so they use coal. So they use their remaining coal energy plants. And they increase the amount of carbon emissions. So that's why you talked about Germany and how they, in an attempt to go renewable, actually increase the amount of coal use. And that's the mechanism.
Nice. We should also say, just there to clarify, so one of the issues with like wind and solar is that we don't know how to efficiently store the energy, right? So a natural question is like, if it's, you know, if it's really windy or like really sunny, you know, we're probably not using all that energy right away. Can't we store it somewhere? And that is kind of an open problem, honestly. We're not sure how to efficiently do that.
The only storage system that works on a gigawatt scale, which is what you need for the level of cities, is something called pump water storage, which is super easy to understand. You just pump a shit ton of water up to a high place. And then when you need the energy, you let the water go down again and it spins turbines. But to do pump water storage, you need to have a city next to a mountain, which has a flat top, because you need a high place to put the water. And so you simply don't have most cities that are there. This comes from Vaclav Smil, who is amazing and everyone should read. So you have energy density, you have reliability, and then you also have environmental cost. And so carbon emissions differ from the various sources. So coal is much more carbon emitting than natural gas. And nuclear is the least carbon emitting of all of them, but it has different problems. So we have to be careful of, say, nuclear proliferation and yada, yada. But the main point of all of this is that we shouldn't be thinking about energy sources as like one single energy source is going to save the world. Because even if we power the entire world off of nuclear, we still need fossil fuels for tar and for
plastics
and for roads. Mm-hmm. And you can't lubricate a vehicle with nuclear power, unfortunately. You need fossil fuels. And so what we need to talk about are energy portfolios. We need to talk about multiple different energy sources all working together to best trade off between the various strengths and weaknesses of the each energy source. But so then on the question of developing countries, I think that the WHO says that the biggest source of death in developing countries is indoor smoke inhalation. So this comes from poor people having to burn wood and animal dung to heat their homes and cook their food. And they do this indoor, and it causes exposure to fine particulate matter, which causes all sorts of respiratory illnesses and stuff. The best way to save the lives of people who are choking to death from burning wood is to give them fossil fuels. And this isn't to advocate for fossil fuels as the be-all, end-all, but it is to start thinking about energy sources in terms of trade-offs and in terms of replacements. So when people ask, like, are you for or against fossil fuels? Well, it's a silly question. It's like, what is it replacing? Mm-hmm. And what is it being used for? And so I'm very much in favor of replacing all coal plants with natural gas plants wherever feasible. And I'm very much in favor of replacing all wood burning anything with coal, because we can kind of move up the ladder of trade-offs.
Yep.
And this Puritanism, which says that fossil fuels are always evil, is both counterproductive and it's just, it's silly, because it's hurting the very people that we're trying to help, and it fails to recognize trade-offs. So just to echo and hopefully strengthen what you're saying.
Yeah. Some other stats that I found striking were just like which I didn't realize before actually looking into this, were like the number of deaths attributable to extreme weather events have declined precipitously over time, like an unbelievable amount. And also what's interesting is that the number of deaths by extreme cold are like 6 to 10 times higher than the number of deaths by like extreme heat, which is, of course, this is not to say that, just echoing you, I think you have to do this in these conversations to say, like, I totally recognize that climate change is a problem, that it's like human caused. We're driving up the heat of the planet. Greenhouse gas effect is real, etc. But the question is always like what is climate sensitivity? What is that sensitivity, right? Which is what all these models, the models of the IPCC are trying to figure out. So this is like per doubling of carbon in the atmosphere, what is the effect on the climate? What is the effect on the temperature? And two, like, just what's the human cost, right? So, you know, what are we dealing with when we talk about in terms of just like human lives and human well-being in terms of climate change. So anyway, I just I feel like during these conversations we're gonna have to continually emphasize that, like, yes, climate change is a real thing. Yeah. But anyway, those were two stats that I just found quite striking and not often remarked upon in the mainstream. Yeah.
And there's a bit of a bait and switch, because people will talk about say the frequency of natural disasters increasing, or people will talk about the cost of natural disasters increasing. But none of that matters if the deaths due to natural disaster are declining significantly as they are. Because if you have more hurricanes that hurt fewer and fewer people, and the cost thing is just due to the fact that cities are growing, and so you just have more stuff to break. If you think about that as significant, but fail to look at just the number of people who are dying for each of these, then you're not really thinking clearly, right? Because it doesn't actually matter if there's more hurricanes if they hurt fewer and fewer people, right? Or if we create cities that are more resilient to these natural disasters, as, like, I think the Netherlands is, what's the stat? The Netherlands is like 6 or 7 feet
under sea level.
Level. But they have built technology to prevent water from rushing in. And, like, and people talk about water as if it's going to just destroy everything. But think about Venice. Like, you can have full cities completely immersed in water, and technology will overcome it.
Yeah.
On the importance of energy thing, I want to say one other point, which is that, so big plug for Michael Schellenberger. If you want to read someone who's thinking clearly about these issues, please read Michael Schellenberger. But in his book, he talks about the rebound effect. Did you catch this one? The rebound effect is kind of interesting. So one common solution to climate change that people will talk about is, like, say, lifestyle changes. So it's better to, say, eat less meat, and that's a good way to fight climate change. But the problem is, if you switch your diet to, say, a plant-based diet because of climate change reasons, plant-based diets tend to be cheaper, and then you have extra money, and then you're going to spend that money on stuff, and you're going to take that freed up money and you're going to maybe take an extra trip somewhere, or you're going to take that money and buy an extra pair of shoes or something. And so when you account for the fact that consumers will re-spend their saved income on consumer goods and thereby add to the carbon emissions by buying extra stuff that they wouldn't have bought if they were to, say, stick to a meat-only diet, then the net energy savings is quite negligible. And the point of this is, so this is called the rebound effect, that if you try to change your lifestyle in a particular way such that you mitigate carbon emissions in one aspect of your life, then it's very difficult to do that without increasing carbon emissions in another aspect of your life. The key example of that is everyone switching from plastic bags to cloth bags. The amount of energy that is required to make cloth bags compared to plastic bags is significantly higher. So you have to use a cloth bag, I think, like, numbers like 127, in the hundreds, to make up for the increased energy of making that cloth bag. So it's called the rebound effect. And the takeaway is that this is why energy density is so important, because if we focus on going to nuclear power compared to fossil fuels, it doesn't matter where people rebound, right? Because we are producing more energy with fewer carbon emissions. And so if listeners are like, what can I personally do? I think it's less important to take on this like ascetic view of life and start making these personal lifestyle choices, and more important to start educating yourself on the benefits of nuclear power and convincing other people that nuclear power is a good thing. Because I think there's a huge fear in the culture of nuclear power. And that's its biggest impediment to it being widely adopted, because the technology works. It is the solution to carbon emissions. And the only thing that's preventing it are regulations and public fear and the fact that it's not politically viable. But if you have some time to look into the nuclear power strengths and weaknesses and try to advocate it as a solution, then that is doing a significantly more for the environment than making personal lifestyle choices. And so just a reason why the focus on energy efficiency isn't arbitrary. It's like everything funnels back to energy, because it's not just about cutting back here and there, because to cut back, you tend to have other behavioral changes that increase your energies.
And I mean, also the energy density point is so important because it lets you also focus on other things that climate change advocates are often focused on. So like biodiversity, maintaining forest and stuff. But if you lose the plot with respect to energy density, what you end up advocating for are like sort of localized solutions that lose the sort of like economies of scale aspect, right? Mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. So if you ask every town to like produce its own energy locally, and like you forget that what matters is like energy density and creating centers that produce like as much energy as possible, you end up like spreading the impact of mm-hmm. creating energy like all over the place, right? So this is one of the problems with renewables mm-hmm. is there's not that energy dense. And so to create like the same amount of energy that you get with like one fossil fuel plant or one nuclear power plant, you end up taking like thousands and thousands of acres of land, right? And like you can see this in Germany, exactly. Where they've had to clear so much forest land to be able to do this. Or you see this in the Amazon, right? Like, which was like a, you know, mm-hmm. Greenpeace was advocating for only being able to allowed to produce like so much energy per amount of area. And what this resulted in was like more clearing of the Amazon, right? Because now you have to like spread your energy production outwards instead of concentrating it in like in certain places.
Just something to emphasize with the nuclear thing is like when you and I are talking about how we're big fans of nuclear power, it's because we believe climate change is a real problem and that nuclear power is a way to solve it.
Yeah, right? Exactly.
And it's just important to emphasize that because climate change is a problem and this is a great way to mm-hmm. mitigate mm-hmm. it. And contrast this against the environmentalist movement, which says that climate change is a problem and the best way to solve it is to abandon the one solution that has zero carbon emissions and that is able to be scaled up and that is a viable technology that we have today. It's not like we're trying to make some miracle new technology. It actually works right now. And it just, I don't understand the fucking hypocrisy and the contradictory nature of the environmentalist movement, where they will simultaneously scream about how the world's going to end in 10 years and also scream that the biggest solution to this can't be used. And I don't understand this tendency, but it's so prevalent. And it's like I imagine many of our listeners, because we haven't talked about the subject, right? So many of our listeners are being blindsided by our opinions here, I would imagine. Like unlike the other niche topics we've talked about, like this is one that is like affecting people right now and that many of our friends and family probably disagree with us about and have a very different impression of the state of the world.
Send those emails. I want to, let's get going. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Here's a question. What do you think about Greta Thunberg?
Oh, man. Well, okay, there's two questions, I think, there. One is just, like, what do you think of her actions? And then two, I think, what do you think of, like, her as a person? And as her as a person, I feel quite bad, to be honest. I think she's, like, basically being taken advantage of by interest groups. Just, like, mm-hmm. steered in a certain... She's, like, a fucking young girl, man. I just feel like she's a fucking teenager who I think is probably really passionate about this stuff and really believes she's like really helping the world. And I think honestly, she's being co-opted by a certain, So her as a person, I feel quite bad for, honestly. And, her actions I think are quite harmful, to the entire movement. Like if we're concerned about the potential downsides of climate change and like trying to mitigate its worst effects while maintaining as good a quality of life for as many people as possible, I think she's doing a direct disservice to that entire project. I think like advocating a return to, so like, you know, her stunt with like sailing across the Atlantic in a sailboat is like, you know, that's a call to like return to basically pre-industrial times, which I think is as anti-humanist as you could get. Like, right? Like, this is like a call to return to times when children's lifespans were incredibly short and like the probability of dying as an infant is very... Anyway. But I think in general, just the inducement to panic by people, right? So she has quotes where she'll say like, if you're not panicking, something's wrong. Or like, if you're panicking, good. I want you to panic. This is a terrible way to think about like how to, one, convince people that something is a real problem, but two, how to actually solve that problem. Panic is not conducive to like a sober reflection about like where we are at right now and how to like make progress.
It's, you know, it's so funny. I had a experience. So I was talking to some colleagues about this issue, and I disagreed quite strongly with them, who were basically taking the Greta Thunberg, the world's going to end, and we need to do everything we can mm-hmm. right now line. And what they said is, I remember this so distinctly, that one friend of mine said that it's so serious that he thought we should resort to activist tactics, by which he meant not educating people, but terrifying them. Wow. Like going and like what are activist tactics? It's placards, it's slogans, it's trying to get people to act as quickly as possible. It's not an informed conversation. It's not a debate. It's not a sober look at the evidence. It's like panic, fear, and join the movement.
It's FUD.
It's FUD. It's fear, uncertainty, and doubt, Mr. Eric Weinstein. Exactly. And it's not coincidental that people will put down their BLM placards and pick up their climate change mm-hmm. placards. And it's the same people running around the streets, because once you fear the future and you think that everything is going to collapse, then you lose your critical faculties. You start not viewing people who have different views than you as conversation partners, but you view them as the enemy, mm-hmm. right? You view them as people who are getting in the way of your mission. And this is so damaging to society, because it destroys the mechanism by which we make progress, which is talking to people who think differently mm-hmm. than you do, right? And debate and discussion, and that's how we learn. And when you are told by charismatic speakers that we're in such dire straits that the only thing you should do is panic, and then try to take down capitalism, this is not helping yeah. the poor. Like, let's move the conversation to the media mm-hmm. aspect of it a little bit, because I think that for most people who are just trying to be conscious consumers of the news and figure out what's going on in the world, they're hearing endlessly that like the world's going to end over and over and over again. And no one's really at fault here. Like, I don't want to take it's the mass media. It's more just this like horrible incentive structure yeah. where certain kinds of headlines get more clicks, and then people click on these kind of headlines because they're scared of previous headlines that they've read.
I mean, the media question is quite fascinating, because on one hand, I agree that there's like this weird incentive structure where sort of like fear gets the front page. But at the same time, yeah. these claims that like we can only survive another 10 years have been happening since like the 80s. Right. So yeah, yeah. What is, like, to the extent where like the IPCC has had to roll back some of the statements it's made, right? So the IPCC report is split into two parts. There's like the summary for policymakers, and then there's the actual science. And I haven't like taken a deep dive yet into them, but from what I understand, these two distinct parts of the report can be quite independent of one another, right? So yeah, I don't know if there's different people writing the summary for policymakers as like writing the scientific report, but it yeah. seems like the incentives for the summary for policymakers is just like different, or at least people's like personal opinions can come out a little more. But you know, there's been so for one, like the models of the IPCC from like the 80s and 90s have just been like wrong, for you know. So it's just like what they'll do is typically in these reports they'll have like many model runs with different parameters, and then they'll report like the best case scenario, worst case scenario, mean scenario, right? Like just to give an example, like from the 2014 report, I think like 111 out of 114 of these model runs were like a huge, in terms of like where we were supposed to be at in 2019, but like a massive exaggeration for where we were. Anyway, what am I trying to get to here? Like the on the one hand, there is like a huge amount of media hype about all of this, but on the other hand, this has been happening for a long time. So I'm not quite sure what's going on. Like, at what point do you sort of lose the fear-mongering credibility? Like, you'd think that would happen at some point, no?
I have a supposition that a lot of the current left-right divide that we've been talking about is actually like a generational divide. Like, it's a 20-something versus 40, 30, 50-something. And that would partially explain this whole, like, at what point do you lose credibility thing? Because you always have a generation of 20 to 30-year-olds who are hearing these claims for the first time and freaking out about it. And then you have people who are older who have heard this for their entire life. Like, to the listener, do you remember hearing when you were young that acid rain was going to destroy everything? Because I remember being educated on that. And then it just disappeared. Like, people stopped talking about it. But, like, if you just think for a second about acid rain, like, that is a terrifying thing to teach to kids.
Yeah, that's fucking crazy, man.
Like, you step outside and your face is going to melt with acid. But this is scary stuff, right? Like, it's acid rain. Like, that's crazy. So then there's another aspect. I think there's, this also came from Schellenberger. I think there's like a double distillation process. And what I mean by that is you have these giant IPCC reports that are written by hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands, mm-hmm. of people across the entire world.
And they're huge. They're big.
And they're huge, right? And then you have journalists who go through them and find certain claims which are pretty stark, but which, when read in the larger context, is caveated quite carefully. But the journalists pick out the most stark pieces of the report. So that's the first distillation process. And then the second is that you have people picking out the most stark news articles. And then you get a bunch of news articles. And then you get people like Extinction Rebellion taking the most sensational news articles, which then magnify the claims a second time. And how come this can happen over and over and over again since like the 70s, but actually since like Malthus in like the 1800s,
exactly,
is I think that older people remember and younger people don't. And so you always mm-hmm. will have a generation of people who are hearing this stuff for the first time and will be freaking out about it. And I don't know if this is the case, but I would be willing to wager that the average age of Democrats versus the average age of conservatives differs significantly. I don't know if that's the case or not, but I think it is true to say that people get more conservative as they grow mm-hmm. older. And like, I'm not experiencing me being more conservative, but I am experiencing me being more and more fed
yeah,
up
exactly.
with the bullshit from the left, which I think might just be a process of maturation. But I would love to have like an age analysis of voting patterns. And I anticipate mm-hmm. that would account for some of it.
It actually takes some significant intellectual energy not to just reactively swing to the right. Actually, I found like I have to calm myself down sometimes from like some of the stuff that comes out of the left and not just like just reactively.
Yeah. Although seeing some people on the right talk about vaccines as if it's so there's craziness on the right. And I think
that's true.
It would be fair to say that if we grew up in a culture where people are far more right wing, we would reactively swing against the dominant milieu in which we find ourselves.
That's a great point. Yeah. Like if most of my friends leaned right, I'd probably be equally fed up with that nonsense. Yeah. Yep. That's true. One thing I'm curious about is Schellenberger, probably a third of his book is dedicated towards like basically the corruption or at least the like coalition between like environmental groups and a lot of just like fossil fuel groups to like try and like ban nuclear and just like a lot of the shady underground dealing that goes on there. I was very aware while reading that it was like very much fitting into like my biases. And like, if I was to read that of some group that I held in high regard, I would be like I'd be very skeptical of those claims, right? Like sort of people being paid off to say certain things and like, et cetera, et cetera. So one, I guess, did you get into that part of Schellenberger's book at all? And two, what did you
heard him talk about this on podcasts, not I didn't get to that part of the book, but in general, I tend to downweight a lot of those kinds of claims that people are doing it for money purposes. Obviously, money is a prime motivator and lobbying is a thing and stuff, but I think Scott Alexander had an excellent piece about how like all the money from some industry, I don't remember what, is like less than what the almond lobby pays to lobby for almonds. I steer away from those kinds of claims about X group is funding X cause because it's really hard to say how much influence being paid has compared to all of the other factors in a particular politician's life. So in general, I just tend not to think too much about those kind of claims, but I see the purpose of what Schellenberger is doing because this is something that's commonly said about the fossil fuel industry, that they're funding all of these organizations. And I see a lot of what Schellenberger is doing is just saying, well, if you want to play that game, I can play it too. And it's by no means clear that shady money is only coming from the fossil fuel lobby. And in fact, you have a lot of money coming from the other side as well. So that whole game of money is influencing decisions. It's like that is one piece of the whole network, but like I tend to steer away from all claims of that sort.
Yeah, nice. Yeah, yeah. It's just a hard game to play when you get into like this much money was paid to this person, and this much money played to this person. Like,
what would be persuasive to me is if we found some letter that said, "Because I received this money, I did this thing."
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Often the kind of thing that like a Eric Weinstein would say. It's not pure conspiracy, but it leads to kind of the conspiracy area.
It's also unclear how much it does at the end of the day. Like, I think you sort of want to disabuse people of like certain ideas or like propose certain ideas, right? I think that's kind of how you change people's minds slowly, of course, like no one adopts an idea immediately, but just like showing someone that someone got some money for something is like rare, you know, whose mind is that going to change? Like, AOC is not going to change her position on nuclear because Roger Pilkey was shown to not be tied to the fossil fuel industry, right?
Yeah, like, that's a great point. That's very uncommon for money to override ideology, I think.
Exactly. So, okay, so one very speculative thing I wanted to bring up was just, it's like a sort of Jordan Peterson-esque take on the subject, which is like, people have a desire for either like, I'm not sure whether to call it a spiritual desire or just something to look up to, like a Nietzschean like idolatry or something. Yeah. But yeah, do you find yourself convinced by arguments that say like people are replacing traditional spiritual and religious practices with a divine perspective on like nature and the environment as like, you know, as the environment is something that we should not tread upon, that we must like respect, and we must like humans must bend to the environment's will as opposed to the other way around, like as if it's taken the place of God or something, right? What's your take on
that? Context for that is this is, I guess, one third of Schellenberger's book, right? Is he concludes the book with some speculations on like why this is so common, and he is kind of taking a John McWhorter line that it's filling the religion shape hole in many people's hearts. I think there's truth to it. I would frame it slightly differently because I don't think that religion created this desire and then religion left and environmentalism fled in. I think it's more that humans in general have a need for purpose and a need for good guys and bad guys. And this is a tendency which religion exploited, but when religion leaves, other things are going to exploit this too. So I see it more as a consequence of human nature, which religion held the ring for a while because it satisfied these needs. But when religion leaves, we're going to have other things that are going to start satisfying these needs because people, like we all feel this, like we want to help. We want to know that our life isn't just about getting up, going to work, going to bed and dying. We want to feel like we're contributing something of value. We want to make the world better. I think everyone has that kind of feeling in their hearts. And religion was a great way to satisfy that need for a lot of people. But now that's kind of, and it's a good thing that it's disappearing, but that need is still going to be there. Yeah. And it's interesting that both John McWhorter and Michael Schellenberger are saying the same thing. They're both right, but it's not as if we didn't have religion, we wouldn't have this problem. We would always have this problem. I don't know. Does that satisfy me?
That was very nice. So yeah, religion is not the prime mover there. It's like a deeper, it's the religion itself is a result of like a deeper impulse. And then as soon as there's a vacuum there, other things sort of fill in to
like
the void.
In the best case, I think what is flooded in is like a sturdy worldview and a philosophy. Like learning an epistemology is like an anchor point for me. And it's something which gives my life meaning and something which I want to spread to the world. And I feel this need to evangelize. But I've kind of taken that need and anchored it to almost a religious devotion to the power of criticism, because it's the only way that I've found to be able to take that impulse and make it something productive, where humility is one of the core precepts, I guess. I don't think that if religion didn't exist, these problems wouldn't exist. We just have a different kind of religion.
Yeah, interesting.
I feel guilty because we've said a bunch of stuff that our listeners have not been brought up to speed on.
Also, I mean, even if you, dear listener, do not have like criticism necessarily, it would still be useful to hear about like what aspects of the issue we should dive into, because hopefully we can maybe have some people on that are experts in various domains. But it would be great to know what areas we sound the weakest on, or like where our perspectives are lacking that we can really dive into. And also, it just helped guide my learning a bit, because even just like trying to get a handle on this debate is quite confusing, and there's just like floods of information from all sorts of angles, and it's like trying to sort through every claim made by everybody is an exhausting endeavor.
So we'll do it for you, listener. Tell us what you want to investigate, and we'll
we will be the religion shaped hole.
All right, man. Well,
all right, dude.
To be continued.